The first time I met him was during my first few days of my sub-internship at the pediatric HIV clinic. I walked into the room, and I noticed a young man sitting in a chair with his back to the door and his back to everyone else, with his forehead resting on the exam room table. His primary provider was on the other side of the room talking with a social worker about some aspect of his care. And I was struck by how disengaged he seemed. I quietly walked up to him, bent over, and said, "Hi, my name is Chinadu." He slightly turned his head, smiled a little bit, and said, "Hello." He had been coming to the clinic since he was a young child, because he was born with HIV. And to describe him to you, he was about 6 feet tall, dark, smooth skin, really soft, baby fine hair, which sounds kind of nice, but in a 19-year-old man, it was terribly out of place, as was how utterly skinny he was, almost like a skeleton with skin. I saw him several times after that in the clinic, and also in his numerous hospitalizations that he had from complications of his disease. And when I'd come visit him in the hospital, we'd do a lot of things. We'd talk. Well, we'd talk as long as I brought Gatorade, because he loved Gatorade, especially grape. And we'd play bingo. And for those of you who are familiar with the Children's Center, Wednesday afternoon bingo is no joke. Or we'd take walks around the hospital. Well, actually, I would walk and push him around in a wheelchair because he was too weak sometimes to stand. But mostly we talked. And we talked about what it was like to have his disease and whether he thought it would get this bad. And he said, "No, I didn't really know." And I'd ask him, "Well, why didn't you take your medicine?" And he said, "Well, I've been taking medicine since I was 7. And sometimes I just didn't feel like it. Like I'd throw the meds away or I'd hide them. My mom tried to make me take them, but I didn't feel like it, so I'd hide them under the bed." I was like, "Okay, I understand. You were a kid. But you're a young man now. Why aren't you taking them now?" He's like, "I'm not going to lie to you. I didn't feel like it. I mean, it's not like I had a choice in having this disease. I was born with it. And taking the medication was the only choice I had control over. I didn't feel like explaining to my friends why I had a baggie full of pills. I didn't feel like wondering about the side effects of this medication or that medication. That kind of thing really messes with your head," he said to me as he points his bony finger to his temple. But he says, "If I knew then what I know now, man, I would make a different choice." So his care transitioned from the hospital to hospice as his disease progressed. And I would go visit him in hospice. And it seemed really odd to see a 20-year-old man amongst 60, 70, 80-year-old people, all of them dying. And I'd say, "What do you do here?" And he goes, looks at me, "We play bingo, of course." It's like, "Oh, right, naturally. Okay." Then one day, I got the call. And it's the kind of moment you think you're ready for, but then you realize you really aren't. He was really dying. I got in my car after work, and I'm driving. My thoughts are all jumbled. And I'm thinking, how do I say goodbye? How do I say goodbye? How am I going to say goodbye? And I think, I'm not ready. I need more time. I need more talks. I need more Gatorade. I need more visits. I need more bingo. I need more time. But my selfish desire for more time flew out of the window once I saw him. He had been going in and out of consciousness all day, occasionally waking up to vomit blood. He was curled up on the bed, smaller, darker, drier, and more frail than I ever remember him being. At the sound of my voice, he lifted up his head, looked at me with unfocused eyes and moaned, and then fell back into the bed. The burden of his disease was just too much for him to bear. I sat down on the bed, sat down in a chair next to the bed, and put my hand on his leg. And he looked around the room. I connected names to faces of all the people he told me about in his stories. After a little while, I got up to say goodbye. I walked to the head of the bed, bent over, kissed him on the forehead, and whispered in his ear, "Thank you. Thank you for being my friend." I walked out of the room. My feet felt like they were made of lead. My head so heavy from tears. I walked down the hall and down the stairs, and as I was leaving, I noticed a chapel. And I felt compelled to go in. I sat down in the first pew, my head in my hands, and I said, "Please, God, have mercy. Grant him peace." And then I left, knowing I wouldn't be back. The next morning, I got the call, 5:45 a.m. My friend was gone, and the tears that had my head so heavy the day before had my whole body sinking to the floor in grief. I've wanted to be a doctor since I was in second grade. Couldn't really tell you why at the age of 7 I thought that would be a good idea. I think it's because doctors heal and doctors make people better and doctors fix things and doctors take away the pain. And part of my frustration with him was I couldn't heal him. I couldn't make him better. I couldn't make him take his medications. I couldn't keep him alive. And then, in my more perceptive moments, I think maybe that wasn't the point. We as physicians are with patients at sometimes their most vulnerable moments. We sit with them, we talk with them, we silently pray with them, we sometimes scold them, but we are there. And the very best of physicians make their patients feel like people of worth despite their disease. So maybe I did heal him, because he most certainly healed me. Thank you.